From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, the crowd that turned out in Lansing to insist that the governor allow more businesses to operate.
Cars are stretched on every single block around the Capitol for as far as the eye can see.
We'll hear an eyewitness account from one reporter. And today we remember Ellie Peterson, a storied Michigan Republican who rallied her allies to combat Phyllis Schlafly's suggestion that women win over their leaders with home-baked pies.
They said instead of baking pies and cakes and bread for legislators, learn to make the driest martini in town.
Of course, if you really do need to bake right now, we've got you covered as well with tips from the Zingerman's Bakehouse.
I teach people to bake and cook all day long, and so it's rare that I want to go home and do that, but I need a chest freezer right now.
Those stories and more on the way for today's edition of Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, bread recipes for bakers on their last nerve. But first, a crush of cars and trucks, flags waving, horns honking, crowded into the streets in front of Michigan's Capitol today. The group was there to show displeasure with Governor Gretchen Whitmer's stay-at-home order to slow the spread of COVID-19. Some of the protesters spilled out onto the sidewalks and others stayed in their vehicles. In a display so densely packed, one ambulance slowed to a crawl to get through. The protest, called Operation Gridlock, was organized by the Michigan Conservative Coalition. A number of online groups have sprung up with similar views. More than 1,700 Michigan residents have died to date from virus-related complications. Abigail Sensky covers politics and government for WKAR in Lansing, and she was at the protest. Hi, Abigail.
Hi.
Can you describe the density of the crowd for us?
Yeah, so there are about at least over 100 in front of the main entrance to the Capitol right now. People actually outside of cars on the sidewalk, and then cars are stretched on every single block around the Capitol for as far as the eye can see. And there's at least 200 people outside of their cars.
Of 100 people standing on the sidewalk in front of the Capitol, are they spaced out at all?
Spaced out maybe a little more than usual, but definitely not 6 feet for a lot of the people.
Are many wearing masks or other protective gear?
Almost no one has been wearing masks out here. There are a few people wearing N95s and some surgical or homemade masks, but I would say the majority of the crowd in and outside of their cars are not wearing any form of face covering.
You know, from social media, it looked as though the crowd included some just plain folks, maybe landscapers who'd like to get back to work, and also some others who were open carrying or wearing fatigues, saw a few Confederate flags thrown in there. And the white supremacist group Michigan Proud Boys was on site. The crowd looked mostly male and pretty overwhelmingly white. Does that check out with what you're seeing?
Yeah, right now I'm standing on the Capitol grounds facing the Capitol building itself. There's a lot of don't tread on me flags with gentlemen with guns slung over their shoulders, as well as wearing camo patterns or fatigues. And there's a lot of Trump flags and Keep America Great flags mixed into the bunch, and, you know, dozens of American flags as well.
COVID-19 has disproportionately affected the city of Detroit, and especially African Americans. Are you seeing any people of color at this protest today?
I would say that 98% of the people that I've seen are white or white passing individuals. I have hardly seen any people of color or black people out here today.
What are the protesters saying they want to happen?
So a lot of the protesters that I've spoken with are saying that they want exemptions made, whether it's based on industry. I talked to a pet groomer who wanted to allow curbside service for pet grooming. She said she would adhere to social distancing guidelines, wear gloves and masks, but she's from an area of Michigan that has almost no cases, and she told me she has nurse friends who are actually being sent home because they don't have that surge of patients in their hospitals that we're seeing in other areas of the state that have been heavily affected by this outbreak. So she's asking for regional or industry-based exemptions, and that stands true with, you know, what a lot of people have been saying out here.
Did you talk to any of them about the health threat?
Yes, I've brought that up with everyone that I've been interviewing. If they're worried about coming to a protest like this, where people are frankly coming from all over the state and not many people are adhering to social distancing guidelines or wearing masks. And the people that I've talked to said, you know, they're not worried about it. They're taking the precautions that they think will protect them and that are necessary for them, but they're not worried about spreading COVID-19.
Has anybody come out from the Capitol to talk to them?
There are Capitol Police riding around on the bikes, just monitoring the situation. And I know some of the representatives or staffers, at least from inside of the Capitol, were waving American flags out of open Capitol windows on the first floor earlier. But nobody really has come out to talk to them that I've seen.
Has there been any response from Governor Whitmer's office about these protests today?
I saw a couple of members of the governor's office out taking photos of the crowds, and I know the governor plans to speak at 3 p.m. I imagine she'll address the protests then, but not that I've seen, at least while I've been out here.
Abby, it sounds like things are still going full tilt, judging from the sounds in the background, and I believe the protests got organized relatively early this morning. Has anyone you've talked to said anything about how long they intend to keep trying to get their message out there?
Yeah, this protest was planned to go on until at least 2 or 3 this afternoon. Judging by how far cars are stretched away from the Capitol, it will take these cars a long time to get out of Lansing. Many of the cars that I've seen since I got here at around 10:45 this morning are still parked in the same place. So there's not really much movement of the traffic itself. There's just a lot of honking horns, people standing on the roofs of their cars and not moving at all.
Well, they did call it Operation Gridlock.
Yes.
Have you been able to tell if there's anybody just trying to go about their business in Lansing today, trying to get through the crowd?
Yeah, I've seen a few people out on walks wearing masks, as well as a few dog walkers. There appeared to be some workers at City Hall, but most of the people who are out who are not presenting in the protest are media covering the protest itself.
Abby, the Capitol building isn't that far from Sparrow Health Systems Hospital. Do you know anything about how its operations are doing amid all the traffic?
Yeah, so I just spoke with a communications officer for Sparrow Hospital, and he said they're working with the Lansing Police Department to make sure staff get into the entrances. They weren't anticipating this level of traffic. Sparrow Hospital is about a quarter mile away from the hospital, and people are still able to get in, but they are needing assistance from the LPD to make sure their staff get into the hospital itself.
Was there anything else you noticed about the crowd or what's going on down there today?
I just think that the number of people out here not wearing masks is particularly striking. I was here when the legislature voted not to extend the governor's stay-at-home or emergency powers the full 70 days last week, and that was the most people that I'd seen in a month. But this, by comparison, so compared to the legislative session, this is the most people that I've seen around in more than a month, where people, you know, not like in the grocery stores where people are wearing masks and keeping far apart. People are walking closely here, chatting to people outside of their households and walking around without masks or gloves on. And that's really a stark image to see after most Michiganders have been at home or social distancing for almost a month now.
Abigail Senske covers politics and government for radio station WKAR. Abby, thank you so much.
Of course.
We should note that there's another protest action happening in Michigan today. Down the road in Ann Arbor, healthcare workers from Michigan Medicine are joining a nationwide sweep of protests over conditions that nurses, doctors, and patients are forced to deal with amid the lack of equipment and resources. For weeks now, medical staff the world over have begged citizens to stay home and help to flatten the curve of COVID-19 positive cases. Today, Congressman Justin Amash made official what many observers had suspected. He says he's suspending his congressional reelection campaign to explore a run for president. Stateside asked him if he was considering that higher office last July.
Well, it's something I get asked about a lot. I don't think I have some kind of hard deadline in the near future, but at some point, obviously, if you were to do something like run for president, you have to make a decision.
So now it's crunch time for Amash. His district includes Grand Rapids and Battle Creek. He first came to Congress as a Republican and broke with his party over Donald Trump. Amash became an independent and ultimately voted to impeach President Trump in October. Here's what Amash told Stateside the week he left the GOP.
I think we need a very different approach to politics. We need people to return to civility, to be respectful to each other. And in that sense, Donald Trump has been extremely damaging. He's taken things that were bad, the partisan divide, and he's made it worse. So I'd like to see someone elected to the presidency who's going to return us to a system of respect and trust. And even if we have differences on some positions, we need people to be able to work together and talk kindly to each other and, frankly, to love each other.
Today, Justin Amash, one of the conservative stars of the 2010 election cycle, has become a public-facing pariah in Republican circles. He's indicated that he has not made a final decision yet, but earlier this week he said on Twitter, quoting here, "Americans who believe in limited government deserve another option." Amash's congressional reelection bid has drawn several in-party challenges. The candidates include State Representative Lynn Afendoulis, a conservative from Grand Rapids Township, and Peter Meyer, the businessman whose family founded the grocery and retail giant. Coming up, a new series on Hulu features a Michigan Republican trailblazer. That's next on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Tonight, a new series from FX premieres on Hulu called Mrs. America. It's all about the battle for women's rights in the 1970s and now. And let me just say, Cate Blanchett is rocking it as Phyllis Schlafly.
I am not against women. I am not against women working outside the home. But what I am against is the women's liberation movement.
There's plenty to tell about the Michigan chapters in that story. One of the most influential voices of the period, and a foil for Schlafly's conservative views, was Eaton County's Ellie Peterson. A Michigan State Party chair, she rose through the ranks during the late 50s and early 60s, which gave her prime position for the fight over the Equal Rights Amendment and related issues. Sarah Fitzgerald is a Michigan native and former Washington Post editor. She also was the first female editor-in-chief at the Michigan Daily, and she's the author of the book Ellie Peterson, Mother of the Moderates. Sarah Fitzgerald, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks very much.
How did you get interested in Ellie Peterson?
Well, I think it goes back to 1964 when I was 13, and I was watching coverage of the Republican National Convention on TV, and I was astounded to see a woman being interviewed on the national political stage. And I was proud that she came from my home state. And it was Ellie Peterson. She was about to step down as assistant chairman of the Republican National Committee. And she was running for the U.S. Senate that year against Phil Hart. She had been recruited for that candidacy by Governor Romney. And so it stuck in my memory. And as a result, over the years, as I got older and began following politics and women's issues and all, I continued to follow her career. And then in her later years, she moved into the same retirement community that my parents lived in North Carolina.
Oh, wow.
So when I was at a life transition and had a little bit more time on my hands, I approached her about writing her biography because my mother had said she had such interesting stories to tell. And so that was a great experience.
Could you maybe fill in those who may not be as familiar with what kind of position Ellie Peterson held in the Republican firmament, and maybe just sort of for the newcomer, where she stood in relationship to activists like Phyllis Schlafly?
Sure. She ran for Senate in 1964. At that time, there were only two women serving in the U.S. Senate, and both of them had risen into Congress when their husbands died. She was the first woman to serve as a Republican state party chairman when she was recruited to serve in that role in 1965. She served as vice chairman of the Republican National Committee at a time when that was the highest job a woman could hold in a national political party. And then she went on to serve in the President Ford's 1976 presidential campaign. And again, at that point, it was the highest post a woman had served in a presidential campaign.
Did she consider herself a feminist?
Yes, she did. It was a view of herself that she grew into over time as she became friends with more of the women who are featured in the miniseries. She actually viewed Schlafly as a nemesis back in the 1960s. But Peterson became concerned that Schlafly and her conservative supporters were moving into leadership positions. And in 1967, Schlafly was first vice president of the National Federation of Republican Women, and in that job set to become president. And after Goldwater's bad defeat in 1964, the Republican leaders like Peterson were concerned about the continuing impact of conservatives on the party. And so Peterson worked with her moderate allies to engineer the defeat of Schlafly at that Federation convention. Now, it may have been a case where they won the battle but lost the war, because Schlafly left the organization. She took her mailing list. She went on to start the Phyllis Schlafly Report, and a few years later organized the Eagle Forum. And both of those platforms became the basis from which she successfully led the opposition to the Equal Rights Amendment.
In 1976, Peterson was asked to come out of retirement to co-chair the ERA America Coalition. Could you tell us a little bit more about why she decided to do that and what happened when she did get back into the game?
Yes, well, when the Equal Rights Amendment first passed Congress in 1972, it was actually fairly quickly ratified by a large number of states. Then the campaign got bogged down, and many of the women's groups that were working to get the amendment passed were concerned because Schlafly had become sort of the personification of opposition. And they were advised that they needed some women to sort of fill that role at a time when the women's movement was pretty divided. And I think that's one thing that's displayed a lot in the miniseries. So they approached Peterson, who was a well-known moderate Republican woman who had been involved with the National Women's Political Caucus and other activities throughout the 1970s, and Liz Carpenter, who had worked in the Johnson White House and had similarly was a woman of similar age. They were both considered safe, matronly figures who would not scare people the way some of perhaps the younger feminists did. And the two of them agreed to serve as co-chair of the ERA America Coalition. They were both very good public speakers, had good senses of humor, and tried to do what they could to rally forces to get the last few legislatures to approve the amendment. Unfortunately, they were not successful, in part because the coalition was never funded adequately to be successful. But it said something about the respect with which she was held and their political acumen and her dedication to that cause at that point that they did take on that job.
Yeah, there's this moment in Mrs. America where Phyllis Schlafly is talking about her feminist opponents, and she says, they're no fun. And her husband says, well, that's another thing you've got going for you. But it sounds like that maybe does a disservice to Peterson and maybe other women like her who had been involved in politics for a long time and who understood the benefits of a charm offensive.
I think you're right. In fact, Peterson and Carpenter sort of jokingly said they were going to develop a soft shoe routine and banter. And actually, at the 1977 National Women's Conference in Houston, which I think is depicted in the miniseries, They came on at the end of a day-long seminar of training people in how to lobby for the Equal Rights Amendment. It was a skit that poked fun at Schlafly, and they announced they were going to start a newsletter called the Liz Ellie Record, so that they could all $250,000. And in the script, they said of Schlafly, "Now, we're not going to copy her on everything, just the money. We're not going to demand of you that you write letters, wear pink, bake pies, or march. No, we simply say, send us your complete devotion and your $100. And then they went on to give reporters some advice, and they said, instead of baking pies and cakes and bread for legislators, we should get down to the basics. Learn to make the driest martini in town.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Sarah Fitzgerald, a Michigan native who is the author of the book Ellie Peterson, Mother of the Moderates. These two women, Ellie Peterson and Phyllis Schlafly, was there anything that they agreed on or maybe just had in common?
Well, I think they had things in common, interestingly enough. They both grew up in the Midwest. They were both very good public speakers and political organizers. But I think that there were some key differences. Clearly, their politics. Schlafly was much more conservative than Peterson was. Peterson really wanted to try to promote an inclusive Republican Party. She was concerned in the 1960s that Republicans were driving out African Americans at a time when she viewed that we need all the voters we can get. And she was also concerned about their positions driving women out of the party as well, which is something that clearly you have a gender gap today. I think that one key difference is that Schlafly, I think, did like exercise and power. She continued to be prominent in politics after retirement age. Peterson believed in stepping aside, mentoring people. I thought it was interesting, apparently in the miniseries, they have a fictional character who's portrayed as Schlafly's protege, and I'm not sure Schlafly had a lot of identifiable proteges, whereas Peterson had quite a few, including New Jersey Governor Christine Todd Whitman. Mm-hmm. She had another protege who served in the Vermont State Legislature, another one who served for 9 years on the Federal Trade Commission. And so the younger people that she worked with remembered her as that kind of person. It was one reason they gave her the nickname Mother. She, unlike Schlafly, who had six children, Peterson had no children of her own. She had this big network of people who treated her like a mother and gave her a great source of comfort and pride. And so they had similar political skills, but different personalities. And Peterson, to be fair, she would say to people that you shouldn't attack Schlafly, because she has six children and, you know,
she's somebody's mother. Yeah.
Yeah. But that was her choice. And we needed to respect the choices that women made, no matter what they were. And even if they were different than our own.
The miniseries deals a lot with tensions within the women's movement. How would you describe what Peterson's philosophy was on that, both within the Republican Party and maybe also across party lines?
It was interesting because when the National Women's Political Caucus was founded in 1971, Peterson chose not to attend the founding meeting because she asked around and she was afraid it was going to be dominated by women that she thought were more radical than she was. And then when she found out that people like Carpenter and Virginia Allen, who was a friend of hers, who was another leader in Michigan, had been a part of that, she decided she did need to get involved. And she quickly had a job both in Michigan and on the caucus's national council to serve in a leadership role. I think initially she thought it was important to be involved because she wanted to know what the Democrats were up to. She was still kind of viewing herself through the lens of a Republican. But the caucus set out to try to be intentionally bipartisan because they were all very concerned about getting women more involved in their respective parties, particularly when the 1972 conventions were rapidly approaching. At that time, for instance, at the 72 Republican convention, only 30% of the delegates were women, and 3/4 of the male delegates when surveyed said that most men were better suited emotionally for politics than women were. So, and 43% of the female delegates, you know, agreed with that point of view. So you can see what they were up against. It became harder to keep the caucus together on issues other than their common support for concerns for women, because it was at a time of the Vietnam War and some of the traditional differences between Republicans and Democrats over pocketbook issues and national security and so forth. But she did, I think, always try to be a conciliator. I think was one of the reasons she was the natural choice for the ERA America coalition leadership, is that a lot of people liked her, even if they didn't agree with her on all their politics. And I think she also got very frustrated when people would let themselves be divided by these issues rather than try to see what can we build consensus around.
Ellie Peterson obviously didn't live long enough to see the changes in the Republican Party today. She died in, I believe, 2008, right?
That's right.
But what do you think her read would be on the role of women in the party today and just sort of the place that women hold in the American electorate?
Well, she was already pretty concerned about what she saw as the decline in civility and the increase in partisanship back, you know, when we talked face to face in 2006. And so this was something that, you know, had obviously developed for a while. At the end of her life, she had pretty much decided that she was no longer going to define herself as Republican. If you asked her, she would say she was an independent. She became very discouraged when in 1980, the Republican Party abandoned its longtime support for the Equal Rights Amendment. Earlier in the 20th century, actually, the Republicans had been more supportive of the amendment than Democrats had been. Democrats had opposed it because they were concerned about the undoing of a lot of the legislation that had been put in place to protect women in certain jobs. So Peterson's views had already begun to transform. She did live long enough to see some important changes in terms of the growth of women in politics. I think Michigan, you know, now has had two women governors. She didn't see the second one, of course, but, you know, U.S. Senator, a Supreme Court that at one point had a majority of women's justices. And so I think right. She could take some pride in having helped lay the foundation for that. She had supported Hillary Clinton in her 2008 race, and Peterson died a few days after Clinton withdrew, but she was looking forward. I think she supported the candidacy of Barack Obama. She was intrigued that an African-American might be elected president, even if she didn't live long enough to see it.
Hmm. You live, you have Michigan roots, of course, but you now live in the state of Virginia. Virginia just became the 38th state that ERA supporters needed in the 70s to ratify the amendment. Could you maybe tell us about sort of your lens on ERA right now?
Yes, well, it's interesting. I actually, a year ago, when the Virginia General Assembly was still in the hands of the Republican Party, I went down on a League of Women Voters lobby day and went to talk to one of the Republican legislators. Actually, he and his staff represented the district in which my granddaughter then lived. And so I took her along with me and had her sit on my lap. And she was wearing a button that showed a little girl and said, "Not one more generation." And as I was sitting there and hearing some of the same arguments about concern about women being drafted and same-sex bathrooms and so forth, it suddenly hit me that I was actually older than Ellie Peterson had been when she was recruited to serve as co-chair of ERA America. And it just brought home to me the generations of women who had worked for things like women's suffrage and the Equal Rights Amendment, and so many of them had not lived long enough to see success. Fortunately, in Virginia, we did actually, with a change in control of the state house, the amendment was quickly ratified in this past session. Now we'll have a battle over that standing because back during the time when Peterson was working for ratification of the amendment, Congress imposed a deadline for ratification in 1982. And some opponents argue that this doesn't count now because it was after the deadline. And in fact, back then, some states had voted to rescind their ratification. So it's something that'll be battled out in the courts, I'm sure, at some point. But change is slow, but it does happen.
Sarah Fitzgerald is the author of Ellie Peterson, Mother of the Moderates. She's a University of Michigan alum, and she joined us from her home in Virginia. Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Coming up on the show, stress baking in the era of social distancing. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Being stuck inside has everyone feeling at least a little stir crazy right now. And it's surprising how many people are turning that energy toward bread making. We're talking today with Sarah Molinaro. She's a principal lead instructor for the baking and cooking classes offered at Zingerman's Bakehouse. And she's coming to us from her classroom at Zingerman's, which, Sarah, I understand is empty at the moment.
It is, unfortunately. The tables are all askew, and it's very lonely in here, very lonely right now.
Sarah, have you been stress baking?
I have been stress baking. I always tell people when we're teaching classes during normal times, I always tell people, you know, I go out to eat a lot because I teach people to bake and cook all day long. And so it's rare that I want to go home and do that. But I need a chest freezer right now. I have been baking and cooking so much. It's ridiculous.
Oh, wow. Why do you think it is that so many people want to do this at this moment in time when everyone's just completely cooped up?
I've been thinking about that. I think there's a couple reasons. I think there's the fear. What will I be able to buy at the grocery store? What will be available? What won't be? You know, there was such a run on flour and yeast initially. It was incredible.
Well, and loaves of there were very few loaves of bread available, at least at the stores in our area.
Oh, absolutely. And so I think there's something very comforting about bread, period, full stop. And so I think the fact that people are able to, with the right recipes, with a minimal amount of equipment, bake bread at home and nourish their families, I think there's something very comforting and reassuring in that in a time when very little else is.
Do you think that it offers people a sense of creativity as well?
I think so. I think that, you know, we live in this world where you have so many options for recipes. There are so many cookbooks. There is so much information out there. And so you have so many sources that you can go through and find something that works for you. And also in the day-to-day lives, people always tell us in our classes, you know, they come to bake, they're able to bake here, but, you know, in their day-to-day lives, they don't have time. And so suddenly a lot of people have more time than they know what to do with. So that plus the creativity is leading us to a lot of good bread and other baked goods.
Just to remind folks that you are coming to us from the Bakehouse, so any sounds that people hear are baking related.
Correct.
Sarah, I understand you're fortunate enough to still be employed right now.
I am, which I don't take for granted at all. I think these are very tenuous times, and so I'm very grateful to Zingerman's. I'm grateful to have a job, and I'm grateful to be, you know, food service and restaurants have really taken a hit, and I'm glad that people still want bread and need bread and that there is a need and demand for the knowledge and the skill set that the Bakehouse is able to bring people.
What does your job look like right now?
Right now, what I've been doing for the last couple of weeks is we haven't had a class here in close to a month. And so what I've been working on now is I was making sourdough starters at home. I was doing a lot of videos around that to get people started and take them through the Zingerman's process of how we get our sourdough breads and all of our naturally leavened breads. I'm still doing some recipe testing for when things do return to normal, whenever that may be. And I'm starting to work on online classes, so Google Meet classes for people who want to bake together, want our knowledge, once again, our knowledge and skill sets, but can do so comfortably from their own home. So we'll see how that goes.
What are you recommending to folks who may be coming to bread baking, absolute beginners?
I think that you need to be kind to yourself. I think you need to understand that there is a lot of changes, and there's a lot of knowledge with bread baking that comes from making mistakes, and that's okay. And that's okay. You know, so much of working with yeast, with working with sourdough starters, is a lot of trial and error. If I had a dollar for every bad loaf of bread that I've made, I would have probably upwards of $10,000.
I mean, it's kind of the fly fishing of baking, I feel.
I do. I think I totally agree. You know, I think that people often say that they're afraid of yeast, that they don't understand yeast. And I can tell you that so much of what I've learned about baking came from making lots of mistakes. And that can be frustrating to people, especially when, you know, right now in this world, you just want to make a good loaf of bread and know that it's going to taste good. But, you know, so much of, you know, the weather's been hot, it's been cold. There's all these factors that come into play when you're learning how to bake bread. That said, I've gotten a lot of positive feedback from students that I've been interacting with, and they say, well, it wasn't great, but it was still the best loaf of bread that I've ever made, and I think that's wonderful.
And that's a wonderful bar to keep in mind. Are there basic rookie mistakes that you might steer us around at this time?
Yeah. You know, I usually avoid recipes on Pinterest. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say that, but I just said that.
You just totally went there. Yeah.
Sorry. People post beautiful things. But I think that when I'm looking at good cookbooks, I always want to make sure that the recipe is in weight. And if people have kitchen scales, this is a great time to get familiar with them, because so much of bread baking, when you're measuring, volume measuring 6 cups of flour, if I were to do that, you would end up with a totally different amount when you went to weigh it. And that's because volume measuring cups are not created equal. And so there can be a lot of variability, and weight really helps rule that out as one of the factors that could come into play where things can go wrong. The other thing I would say is that when a recipe says you mix your dough and then you let it ferment, and fermenting is when you just have this bulk blob of dough covered in a bowl, and a recipe will say, well, it's been an hour, so the bread must be ready. Well, you know, on a day like Saturday, almost two weeks ago, it was 70 degrees outside. You know, after an hour, that may be ready. On a day like today, or a few days ago when it snowed, you know, it may take a little bit longer. So I think learning to understand that your home environment, and whether it's cooler or warmer, you know, whatever's going on outside and inside, really come into play. I would say people often underproof their loaves of bread. And what I mean by that is that the yeast has not done everything that it can do at room temperature. And so I see a lot of loaves of bread when people take pictures. I always tell them to cut the bread in half and take a picture of the cross section. And I'm looking at the crumb structure. So, you know, what does the loaf look like? And if it's really dense and heavy at the bottom, that means the dough is underproofed. So, you know, if a recipe says proof it for an hour, ferment it for an hour, if it's cold out, I would say let it go 15 minutes longer, let it go 20 minutes longer, and you're going to get a lot better lift and bake on your bread.
It's just so funny. I got into Lori Colwin's book, Home Cooking, her baguette recipe,
yeah.
And it's rock solid, but it was also, you know, New York in the 80s. So, like, ingredients that she was using are not what I am using right now.
Sure.
And just any number of things. But at the same time, I mean, I don't think it came out the way she intended it, but it tasted
right.
Pretty good.
That's what I'm saying. So it's kind of like, you know, we're all doing the best with what we have in front of us, with the time that we have allotted. We're having to substitute ingredients, you know, and so we have to have some flexibility. And that can change the end result. But no one's to say that the end result is a total failure. If you're still eating it, I think that's beautiful.
Any baker who's going to the grocery store has noticed something that you mentioned, that there's some pretty key ingredients in short supply. Do you have any pro tips for us on finding what you need or working with what you have?
You know, it's funny. I have some family that live out in Los Angeles, and my aunt was up in arms, and she said, I just cannot find flour anywhere. And I will say that and I was like, okay, you're only going to one grocery store. And I understand we're all sheltering in place and we're not supposed to take excessive trips around. But I have been surprised that what's totally out at one store, you know, I drove to a smaller market, you know, or sort of a more local chain, and I had everything I needed. So just kind of steering people more local if possible, because I found that those stores need our business more anyway. But, you know, I think that it's always worth calling ahead. I know that's probably goes without saying. But, you know, there's some things. If you can't find whole wheat flour, for example, you have a lot of other options. This might be a great time to try what are known as ancient grains. You have kamut, you have spelt, you have einkorn. So try out one of those. I think that's wonderful. It's hard to find a substitute for all-purpose flour. If you can't find that, you can't just, you know, throw a bunch of oatmeal in there and hope for the best. But there, if you can't find certain dairy, if you can't find, you know, for example, you're like, oh no, I can't find, you know, chocolate chips. Well, buy a chocolate bar and cut it up. I mean, there's, you have more flexibility than you think. Sometimes I found people get very married to a recipe and they're like, oh, I can't deviate at all. And while we do encourage you to always try a recipe the way it's written the first time, we understand that, you know, there can be flexibility and we can figure things out and they're still going to be awesome.
I keep seeing all these posts on Twitter about making your own yeast. It all began with this chemist who was like, you guys, you don't have to buy this stuff.
Yeah.
Have you tried that?
I have not, but I have a coworker who took a grape and put it in some water. And there's lots of wild yeast, specifically on grapes and raisins. And she was able to capture that wild yeast and she made bread with it. I mean, it was incredible.
Shut the front door.
No, I swear. No, it was beautiful. She sent me the loaf and I was like, Sue, this is amazing. So I have to say that if you can't find yeast, and you know, there's yeast around us. I happen to have a lot of yeast around me because I'm in the bakehouse right now, but there are other options and other more common ingredients than you would think that can help you along in that particular process. It's pretty cool.
Are there any particular recipes that you'd recommend? You gave us a hint of like what to steer around, but What's a good all-purpose bread recipe that you like?
So I'm going to toot Zingerman's horn for a moment, if I may, and say that we have a Zingerman's, we call it our Bakehouse White Bread, and we put the recipe out on our website at the beginning of April. I want to say it feels like 1,000 years ago, but I know it wasn't that long ago. And, you know, very straightforward ingredients, some dairy, some all-purpose flour, a little bit of salt, some yeast, some milk, and some butter, a little bit of sugar. And you've got really your almost perfect loaf of white bread. And that to me is a really great beginner's recipe when you're just starting out with bread. And people, you know, we have a really active Facebook group here of baked students. And so people have been posting their results and they've been troubleshooting with each other. And I can see a lot of learning happening, but I can also see people baking with their children, you know, kind of grandparents baking virtually with their grandchildren. So I feel like it's a really accessible recipe.
What else are you baking right now? You said you're getting close to needing a chest freezer. I want to hear what else is cooking.
This is true. I love cookies. I'm making a ton of cookies. I'm actually doing some recipe testing we have a cookie class that we run in December. So I'm trying out different cookie recipes for this particular class. At home, not so much baking, but I've been cooking. I've never braised so much meat in my life. I don't know what it is. It's like, I think it's the same idea as making bread. It just feels very comforting to have a tremendous amount of braised meat on hands. I'm not sure why I'm channeling with that. Some ancestors from back
Sarah,
in the day.
Can you freeze that?
Oh, yeah, I am. I absolutely am.
Huh.
Will it be as good? Probably not. But I cook like I'm cooking for 20 people just out of habit. And so I end up with a lot of braised meat. But I can, you know, I can reconstitute it and make it good. I've been making a lot of empanadas. I love a calzone. I find a calzone very reassuring. And in the summer, I love picking fruit. So I've picked about 30 pounds of raspberries last summer. And I'm still kind of working my way through there. Also because I need more room in my freezer.
I'm dying. Is it dinner time yet?
I know.
Well, Sarah Molinaro, we just can't say thank you enough. And we hope that you and yours are safe and that we'll be baking together in better times.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you so much. Take care.
Sarah Molinaro is a principal lead instructor at Zingerman's Bakehouse. As hard as this time is, some have found the experience of physical distancing offers unexpected opportunities. Detroit writer Desiree Cooper is riding out the virus as the full-time caregiver for two parents with Alzheimer's in Virginia Beach. She recently wrote about it in an essay titled, In the Midst of a Pandemic, Some Are Breathing a Sigh of Relief. Here's Des.
Once again, race and class have become the divide between life and death as the Black community bears the brunt of the coronavirus pandemic. Low-wage workers and working poor, many of whom are people of color, are stuck in essential, undervalued jobs, having to risk it all for the convenience of the rest of us. Meanwhile, those of means are watching Netflix, stockpiling goods, and keeping a social distance in a comfortable bubble. It's not easy for the luckiest to admit that what we are feeling in this time of terror is not fear, but a tremendous sense of relief. For some, the world has finally stopped its mad spinning, and they are not sorry for the chance to jump off. I have a relative with several chronic illnesses, including high blood pressure, diabetes, and obesity. And over the course of only 3 weeks working from home, his vitals have improved and his need for medication has dropped. Working from home has changed everything, he said. I was too busy before to plan and cook meals. Now that I'm not just grabbing convenience foods, my blood sugar has leveled off and I'm losing weight. Another dear friend could barely stand going to work every day. For her, the quarantine has been a game changer. She's working from home, but not having to actually show up to the office has made work more tolerable. Her stress is down. Her productivity is up. I'm pampering myself, she said. For her, pampering includes working on a project she's shoved aside for years. I'm doing lots of self-care. I've even taken a couple of baths rather than showers. What a luxury. Another friend is very dedicated to her job, so much so that taking off time was a problem. Last month, she was facing the daunting task of transitioning her parents into assisted living. Even after the emotional move, she still had to go through their old apartment and empty its contents before mid-April. She's one of the countless women for whom finding a work-family balance has been nearly impossible. There was no way I was going to be able to do it while working, she said. But suddenly, we didn't have to go in, and a way opened up. For a moment, I've been able to breathe easier. Although we are all haunted by the specter of death, we are also forging a new way to live. We're going back to planting gardens. Some are dispensing with the weaves, the dyes, the wigs, and the straighteners to get acquainted with their natural hair. Some are seeing this moment as a way to break from negative, even dangerous, relationships. Some are becoming our own barbers. As the work stress goes down, blood pressures are too. We are rediscovering the crock pot. Once we were too busy to listen to that little voice that said, "Call your mother, check on your friend." Now we hear that voice and obey. We are seeing how toxic our pre-pandemic lives have been, how stress is killing us, how important pressures really don't matter, and how all this time our priorities have been upside down. Even as a society, our values have transformed overnight. Appreciation for what teachers endure day in and day out has skyrocketed. Some of our lowest paid workers, the fast food employees, grocery store cashiers, nurses' aides, cleaning staff, garbage collectors, warehouse workers, are all understood as the engines of our way of life. We now see the internet as a public utility that must be made available to all. We are recognizing the need for some version of socialized medicine. I know I'm writing this from a place of privilege. I'm not homeless. I have no chronic medical conditions. I have access to food, water, and electricity. And although I'm sheltering in place with people who need caregiving, none of them are children who can make this ordeal particularly challenging. I'm an introvert, so social distancing is not the hardest thing I've ever done. But the difference between my life now and the life I had prior to the pandemic is that I'm more keenly aware of my privilege and infinitely more grateful. And unlike before, I'm aware that at any moment that privilege can be erased. Those of us who have survived thus far have experienced a monumental reset. We're being called upon to re-examine our priorities, ambitions, sense of worth, and our responsibilities to others. No matter how this ends, I know I can't go back to the same way of living again. I pray that we all will emerge on the other side of this pandemic. And if God sees us through, I pray that we will never, ever go back to normal.
That's Detroit writer Desiree Cooper. She sent that to us from where she's staying right now in Virginia Beach. That's our show for today. I'm April Bear. Wherever you are, stay safe. Thanks for listening.